This is June 27th, 1985. National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. We are having our third interview with Saul Weisberg in the offices of the United Jewish Federation. Sylvia Buse is with Eleanor Mermelstein.
Fourth
interview. Okay. This is really our fourth interview. Saul, the time passes so quickly that I lose track of how many times we've been with you. You had at one point started to give us background on the study on senior citizens housing here in Pittsburgh, and that is so important. We really would like you to elaborate on that.
As I had indicated earlier, there had been a so-called SHEPS study which had issued a series of recommendations for programs to be developed to offer services to the elderly and the chronically ill. One of those recommendations called for consideration of development of housing for the elderly. As I think I probably already indicated, further studies took place and so forth, and eventually an agency called Senior Citizens Housing was brought into existence with Bernard Goodman as president, and with a board consisting of equal representation from the community at large, appointed by the president of the federation, and from the board of the Home for the Aged, appointed, of course, by the president of the home. The pressing issues that confronted that particular agency were, first, how did one develop housing for the elderly? And number two, who should indeed sponsor it and operate it? And number three, where should its location be? There was considerable discussion, indeed rather vigorous debate, about location. Many people felt that housing for the elderly should be located in a busy urban center where the tenants would have an opportunity to have ready access to all the facilities which would keep them stimulated and interested. On the other hand, other individuals pushed very hard for locating the housing on the site of the Home for the Aged, where land was plentiful and where land would indeed be free. It became readily evident that the only way that housing for the elderly could be developed would be with government subsidy. There was at that time just underway a new program under Section 202, as it was called, of the Older Americans Act, which provided direct loans to sponsors of housing. It was 100% practically loans, but there were some significant restrictions, and the cost of land was an important factor in ability to make such a program viable. It was recognized by practically everyone that the home did indeed have an unfortunate image in the community, and that there would be a lot of resistance to people moving in as tenants to an apartment building located on the grounds of the home. Nevertheless, after all the discussions and so forth came to an end, it was agreed that indeed an effort should be made to promote and build housing for the elderly, as it was called, on the land of the Home for the Aged, and that is where Riverview, with which both of you are familiar, of course, that is where Riverview is now, of course, located. The first development was called Riverview 1. It consisted of 108 units. It was actually the first development under the program of Section 202 in what is called the Eastern Region, which encompassed New Jersey, and New York and Maryland and Pennsylvania and so forth. It was an extremely difficult undertaking, very, very time-consuming, an awful lot of red tape, terrible procrastination on the part of the government, arriving at decisions because it was a new program, and every government decision was reviewed by about four levels of bureaucracy. It was really very, very difficult. The board had lengthy discussions also about the kinds of services that should be included, and particularly on the issue of whether food should be provided and to what extent. It was finally agreed that there should be a kitchen, that food should be provided by the home for the aged, there should be a dining room, and that two meals a day should be included in the rental arrangements.
So was this a pioneer concept, or were there prototypes in other places in the country? Or
there were prototypes. As a matter of fact, as I may or may not have mentioned earlier, in the original Shep study, visits have been made to other communities where housing for the elderly had been developed, but not under government subsidy. There was one in New York, which had been developed for refugees, by the way, and it was a very interesting one. The committee visited that. The Home for the Aged in Philadelphia, which at that time was headed by a former Pittsburgher, Art Waldman, who had once been head of what is now the Vocational Rehabilitation Center, Philadelphia Home for the Aged, a leader in services to the elderly, both in Jewish and non-Jewish community, by the way. The Philadelphia Home for the Aged had already developed York House. And finally, which the committee visited, and finally there was a very small, but rather attractive little housing, cluster of housing in a sense, in Cleveland, developed by the National Council of Jewish Women, although for many years thereafter, Cleveland was unable to get anywhere. So there were prototypes, and housing for the elderly, as it's called, was now, in a sense, already the thing to do, and government was already sponsoring and making money available for it and so forth. We did have some very interesting discussions on this question of food. Some of the men on the board finding it hard to conceive of a man even being able to make himself breakfast. Other members of the board feeling very, very strongly that no food should be provided because it would make the tenants too dependent. But as I said, eventually it was agreed that there should be two meals a day. And eventually Riverview was
two meals a
reality.
Day?
A reality. I beg your pardon?
Two meals a day?
Two meals a day. The lunch, which is a light meal, and dinner, which is, of course, a heavier meal. Provision of food, by the way, from the very beginning has always been a problem, as it always is in institutions, always a problem in terms of acceptability and taste and all the rest of it, and always been a very difficult thing. But anyway, after all the problems and everything else, in 1966, Riverview did open up. And interestingly enough, now that I think about it, it was at Riverview, even though I hate to say these things, but I do anyway, even though the speech was delivered by Bernard Halpin, the speech basically was written by me, a speech which Bernard delivered at the dedication. I think it was at the opening of Riverview, not the dedication, at the opening of Riverview, and it was at that speech where the concept of oral history was first suggested.
In what context did you suggest it?
If I can divert for a couple of minutes, maybe
absolutely.
I'll talk about that.
Absolutely.
The context was that there should be every effort made to see to it that the tenants of Riverview would be active and productive citizens. And one possible outlet, if that's the right word, to enable them to be productive was to give them an opportunity to reminisce and recollect. And I followed up on that after it was part of the speech and so forth, and actually did develop a proposal for an oral history program primarily directed towards the health aspects rather than the historical aspects, although I took you very much into account both features. At that time, I'd been reading Oscar Lewis anyway, who happens to be one of the very early anthropologists who did oral history, Portuguese, I guess, Mexican, but anyway. And I put together what I thought was a very good formal proposal, pointing out or making reference to some literature, when I say literature, I mean clinical literature, upholding the notion that reminiscing and recollections were positive features in sustaining the health of the older individual and so forth. And after I put the program together and wrote it up, I shipped it off to the Falk Medical Foundation, sent it to Phil Hallam, but he wasn't interested. Interestingly enough, years later, I was talking to Jim Frank about it, who was at one time, may still be for all I know, a trustee of the Falk Fund, and he was very unhappy to find out that I had done this and that it had never come to his attention and so forth, because he
He's
very
interested in family history.
Yes. And he would, I indicated that he would have pushed for it. Anyway, if I may talk about the oral history for a little bit longer, I don't remember at what point I talked to probably to Frieda and Saul about it. Frieda and Saul Shapiro about it. But Frieda, who was of course active in the Council of Jewish Women, became interested, and she also interested Carol Elias. It may have been that I also talked directly to Carol. I don't remember anymore. But both Carol and Frieda became very interested in it and decided to push it as a project for the council. And I guess they put together a committee, and lo and behold, the council decided to undertake it. I remained in close contact with it, in a way, unfortunately, for the program, I think, as I'm going to explain in a moment. But Frieda and Carol, both of them being, as you know, energetic and doers, managed to move it forward. But we had lots of discussions about what the format should be, because it was really something new. Certainly it was something new insofar as an undertaking for a volunteer group to be concerned. And I, I'm sorry to say, argued that there ought to be an anthropologist to be involved, to give it some shape, some background, and so forth. And the women who were, I guess, as sophisticated in this area as I was, went along with me. And I went to see the head of the anthropology department here at Pitt, Dave Landis, and asked him to recommend an anthropologist to be part of the program. And they recommended a fellow by the name of Elon Shilo, who had been, or was, I guess, that matter, considered to be something of an expert in many Eastern affairs and had a solid Jewish background and so forth. And Elon agreed to do this. You know, I can't remember anymore whether the council paid him a fee or not. I think not. They only paid, I think, Sullivan, Ida Sullivan, for her part in the oral history program. Anyway, the first thing Elon did was to argue, insist, and get his way on the notion that this should become a research project. And so he set up, along with the women, standardized interview which established boundaries and prevented the interviews from being open-ended and so forth, and which I thought was very unfortunate. However, out of that came, by myself, from a book. And out of it, of course, also came the total oral history project in which with which we're involved today.
You feel very proud of your input into that.
As a matter of fact, I always have been pleased with it, although I've always been very unhappy about Elon's role, not only because of successful insistence on research and so forth, which I thought was a mistake, but because he turned out to be a very rigid and, I don't know, on this, I don't mind being on the record, a difficult person, and the individuals who were particularly involved at that time, Frieda and Carol, and I guess even then, I suppose Marsha and Jean were part of it, although I don't really remember too well anymore. I had lots of problems with them. But nevertheless, they were successful. The interviews took place, and as I said, by myself, when the book was finally published, with a cover, by the way, by Tibby.
Very nice cover. Double white for you put into that.
Well, if you look at the cover sometime, you'll see that it was a lovely cover. And one of the funny things about it is that what she wanted to do, of course, was to have photographs and so forth of older people on the cover. So what she did was she used her mother and her aunt and, I don't know, the parents of friends and so forth. So if you happen to have a copy and look at the cover, you'll see you'll see Tibby's mother there somewhere. But anyway, that's the origins of this oral history program. And
seems to me, Saul, almost everything positive that's happened in this community, you've had some influence on. When
thank
you stop
you
to think
so
of it, it's a wonderful perspective we're getting.
But anyway, thank you. But that one was interesting. And then I'll go back to the Riverview thing to talk about this business of attempting to develop services and so forth for the individual tenants, etc. Because there was this long running difference of opinion between Leon Carlson on the one hand and myself on the other. Leon, as I probably indicated earlier, was of course executive director of the whole theater. When Riverview was built, it was only 108 units. There was really no justification, I wouldn't put it that way. It wasn't economically feasible to have a significant professional, high-paid professional, in charge of Riverview. And of course, on top of that, the home group wanted very strongly anyway to have their own professional be in charge of Riverview. So it was agreed that Leon, with a relatively small stipend, would be the executive of Riverview in addition to his duties as executive at the home. Leon's philosophy was to let the tenants at Riverview alone and not really to offer them much in the way of services. My philosophy was really very much different, which was that although every effort should be made to keep the tenants as independent as possible, we should offer them much a variety and many services possible, because that was the way in which you kept people independent. Keep people independent by keeping them active and productive and so forth. This was a long-running dispute in which Leon, by the way, articulated his viewpoint philosophically. I'll make no comment on that. And of course, I did also. As a matter of fact, one of the things I was always very regretful about was that one of the items which I managed to swing in the way of program really came to almost to naught. Not too long after Riverview came into existence, was this before, I think it was only when Riverview, I think it was before Riverview too, it doesn't make too much difference now. One of the garden clubs, Jewish-sponsored garden clubs in Pittsburgh, came to an end. You may or may not remember this, either of you. I can't remember.
It was
Greenbrier, or one of
those? Greenbrier Garden Club.
Greenbrier
yes.
Garden, came to the end of an existence. They had money. I don't know any longer who in the club it was that I was close to, or whether I wasn't close to anybody, but heard about it. But either way, when it came out of existence, I found out that it had several thousand dollars with which it had no. Well, let me phrase it differently. It had several thousand dollars with which it could dispose or apply as it saw fit. So I talked to whoever the leaders of Greenboro was. and it was agreed that they would take the money, give half of it to Montefiore to be used for some landscaping or other, and half of it would go to Riverview. And it was to be used by Riverview, according to my concept, to develop a gardening program in which the tenants would participate with the supervision and assistance, obviously, of the management. I always thought it was, I'm very much interested in gardening anyway. I always thought it was a wonderful idea, but it came to naught because the management of Riverview really just didn't mess around with it very much and finally used the money just for landscaping. Nobody in those days thought that Jewish women were, elderly women were going to be very active in the way of gardening anyway. I remember Nancy Frank saying to me that it was not a program that was going to be successful because Jewish women of the kind of Riverview weren't going to be going out and actively digging in the soil and so forth.
What about the men? There were men there too?
There weren't many men. That's one of the things we can talk about. Anyway, that attitude has changed. One of the things I've always wanted to do at Riverview, as a matter of fact, although I've never pushed it because of differences in attitude and so forth, was to have a greenhouse at Riverview. I could have got someone to build a greenhouse at Riverview. And I happen to have somebody who's one of the best gardeners in the city who probably is now retired, who I think probably could have worked at the greenhouse there and so forth. And I always had visions of having a greenhouse and having the tenants to Riverview, as old as they might be, participate in it, even to the extent where maybe they could grow stuff for sale. But I'm not close to it and so forth. Stanley Shipman has a lot of problems and so forth. I'll let you and Sydney deal with it, and Eleanor. But it's I always thought it was really a wonderful. I don't know if you remember this or not, either of you. Well, you, Eleanor might wasn't. Many, many years ago, before the war, the Allegheny County Workhouse out near Blonox used to grow, the convicts used to grow something.
That's where everybody bought their plants.
Sure, you remember?
Yeah.
Well, I had been.
Visions of
the convicts, but the residents, as we call them, at Riverview doing the same thing and so forth. In a way, the Festival for the Elderly, almost in some respects, although Harriet, I think, would remember this, originated in some ways conceptually from that idea. But anyway, the Riverview one was developed, and tendency was slow, by the way. Tendency was slow. There was a lot of resistance initially, and the people that moved in were people who really had very little or no alternatives. And of course, as you might expect, they were mostly women. However, as time went on, it began to gain acceptability. And it was a good place, although I really did feel very badly about what I felt was a keen lack of services. Finally, it was agreed that another program could be sustained. A substantial waiting list had begun to be developed and so forth. And so efforts were started to put together a second Riverview. When we built Riverview 1, we built with the understanding that it would be possible to make contiguous to the first one a second one, and that it would indeed be further possible to use the kitchen and the dining room. Although the kitchen was not in use, by the way, because the food was being prepared at the Home for the Aged. Well, I'll take that back. I don't remember when. That is, I'm interrupting myself, and I know, but I'll do it anyway. At a certain point, I forget now when, the home no longer prepared the food for Riverview, and the kitchen itself began to be used. But when we built Riverview 1, we built with the understanding that the kitchen and the dining room would be large enough to accommodate additional tenants that would be housed in a Riverview 2. So we put together Riverview 2 with the same board. Riverview 1, as I said, had been a direct loan from the government. Riverview 2 was a different kind of financing program, but again, it was still a relatively cheap rent. It was a more luxurious apartment building than the first one because the limitations imposed by the government had changed. Government had become somewhat more relaxed about the housing program for the elderly, was spending more money and so forth. And where in the first Riverview, the limitation was $10,000 a unit, which was very, very stringent in terms of putting in any amenities, any space and so forth. The second program had a much higher limitation on the cost per unit and so forth. The second Riverview had 136 units, and that meant that the total was going to be 244. The issue at that time came up of what the management should be. I wanted at that point to have the two Riverviews together get their own manager and said so publicly, which meant in a sense differing publicly from a fellow professional in a way which I don't like to do or didn't like to do, but nevertheless I did publicly argue for that. However, the board on the whole disagreed with me. All the representatives of the Home for the Aged disagreed with me. Some of the members of the community at large agreed with me. But nevertheless, it was agreed that Leon should continue.
When was Riverview 2 open?
I think it was 1973, if my memory serves me right. I think it was 1973. And it was very successful. So that as time went on, that the program of housing for the elderly was seen as one of the shining lights, really, of the Jewish communal apparatus. And although I always had some feelings, as I said, about lack of services and so forth, nevertheless, I agreed that overall it had been a very successful endeavor. Now, Riverview, as I said, was a joint venture, Federation and Home for the Aged. There was a bitter argument between the Home and the Riverview, really, about management and about sponsorship and so forth. And indeed, there was an actual contract entered into between the Home and Federation that so long as there was a Riverview on the Home for the Aged, the Home should have the right to have 50% of the board come from the Home board. It doesn't make any difference today because today Riverview is lock, stock, and barrel part of the Home, and I think that's probably not inappropriate any longer. The Home's operating philosophy has changed. Its personnel has changed, and overall, I think Riverview is a good adjunct to the Home, and probably, although I don't know this, is probably integrated into the Home effectively.
It has profoundly affected the kinds of applicants who come to the Home, I believe, because it's been able to help people postpone that.
Oh, yeah.
More institutional admission.
Yeah, well, I always, of course, thought that the only people who go into the Home should be those people who were either completely out of it, so to speak, or who just were in such precarious physical condition that they really needed a whole variety of services immediately available to them. And that should push further and further in the direction of putting people into a Riverview rather than into the Home, despite the significant and substantial physical impairment. And I think that's what did take place. When we first opened Riverview, we had some people who were relatively independent. I remember there was one woman who was only 60, who was under 65.
What was the lower age? 62.
In those days, anyway. This woman, I think she may still be there.
Is the lower age limit still that low?
I think it's still 60. It's government.
Mm-hmm.
It's government imposed. Anyway, trying to speed this up a little bit. as Riverview became obviously a great success, more and more discussion began to take place about undertaking one in the community. And not only discussion, but efforts. And we at the Federation and on Senior Citizen Housing and so forth kept seeking to develop one. And it proved to be very, very difficult. In the meantime, the government had established still another program of housing for the elderly, using what was called a new Section 202 program, which was making money available for construction 100%, just about 100%. But in addition, setting up what is called a Section 8 program.